Więc tak, po pierwsze chcę powiedzieć, że jest to dla mnie wielki zaszczyt występować na tej konferencji, więc chciałbym skierować podziękowanie do naszego pryncypała, do organizatorów za zaproszenie i oczywiście panu przewodniczącemu. Rozpocznę hasłem w stylu Monty Python. A teraz kopyła z zupełnie innego garażu. Temat rzeczywiście jest, odbiega od tych tematów, które moi poprzednicy prelegenci poruszali, ale jak rozumiem, różnorodność naszą dewizą. Adresatem tego mojego tekstu są ewentualni czytelnicy książki, która jest tutaj wyświetlona, to znaczy strona tytułowa. Ludzie, którym jest bliski temat liberal education. Ponieważ zauważyłem, że często popadają w pewne kolejny myślowe, pragnę ich trochę sztuknąć tym swoim wystąpieniem, aby się ocknęli. I dlatego też do tekstu dorzuciłem kilka prowokacji, jak rodzynków do ciasta. W tekście nie taję swoich poglądów, nie jestem bezstronny, ale staram się nie być stronniczym. Świadomie zajmuję stanowisko pomiędzy, liminalne, na styku kultur, czy też na zderzeniu kultur. Powiem też, że jest to praca w toku, więc bardzo chętnie posłucham komentarzy, porad, protestów. A teraz przechodzę na język angielski. It's not an easy thing to talk about a book that for an audience which has not even seen it or heard of it. So what I want to do is to say that I'm going to try to decode certain key terms that appear in the title of the book and in the title of chapters, and I think that's all we have time for and maybe all that we have stomach for. If I can just find... Here's the table of contents. So I want to look at the table of contents, give it a bit of a analysis of writing. Is this are these texts well written? I take the guidelines for writing from a course that I teach called Academic Writing in English, and from a course that I teach with Grażyna Czetwertyńska called Sztuka Pracy Naukowej. I'm also going to try to relate this to certain semiotic analysis, and then at the end, using this structural analysis to try to make a couple of points about liberal education. Why is it such an odd term in Poland and Russia? Nobody seems to like it. And what good could it do, perhaps here at the University of Warsaw? So up until now, the United States, and I want to ask the chair to give me a signal or a sign when I have 5 minutes left. Okay. Up until now, the United States has been the source of knowledge and interest in liberal education, spreading out to the rest of the world. I think it's high time for some critical and constructive feedback from the rest of the world. And that's what this book tries to do. So that's its real sort of real value. Why semiotics? For the present purpose, I think that the value of semiotics is its intention to reveal the context of a discussion and to decode the language in which it's carried out. So that's what I'm going to try to be doing here. Now, as I understand it, semiotic analysis is essentially an exercise in understanding a text by going beyond it, by establishing the cultural context in which it appears, and by disassembling it into its constituent parts, the words and their arrangements, the codes in which meaning is expressed. One of the real values of semiotic analysis, as I understand it, is to go beyond these two ideology. And I'm also going to try to do that in what I'm about to say. The ideology in which the discourse is embedded. And I'm not talking about ideologies in the strict political sense, Marxism, capitalism, nationalism, but to sets of assumptions about ideas and values that guide thinking and practice. In any given text, as in the discourse in which it is born and it evolves, the contexts, codes, and ideologies are most often transparent, invisible. Authors write to convey a meaning, not to draw attention to themselves and to the way that they write their structures of writing. The reader looks for meaning, doesn't stop and analyze the structure as he goes along. So the first step in the analysis is to denaturalize the structures of the text, precisely because of the tendency to take them for granted. The exercise is not merely academic, because identifying the commitments to values and the goals they serve may reveal relations of power that can otherwise remain occluded. Semiotics, at its best, is subversive. Now let me dip into a few guidelines for academic writing. Fundamental to good writing is the mechanism of signal delivery. In Polish, zapowiedź, wspomnienie. Authors use various techniques to signal what is to come. Readers look for these signals to get oriented as to where the text is going, what's happening, and what's going to be delivered later on. An academic paper should have a main claim, easily identifiable by the reader. And let's go back to Polish for just a second. Main claim? Jak to przetłumaczyć na język polski? Trudno. We can try that in the question and answer period. In any case, the aim of a main claim is not to be political, polemical or political, but to state an organizing principle for the ideas and information presented. A thesis statement is the minimum requirement, a statement in the form, I will explore, examine, investigate liberal education. A claim is an assertion that goes beyond what the community of readers knows, states a problem, and posits an answer. The thesis of the claim should be stated at the beginning of the text, so the reader knows what to expect. Signs and signals. An academic paper contains many signs and may itself be taken as a sign. A sign consists of a signifier and what it points to, the signified. It is important to acknowledge the system of meanings in which a given sign or set of signs or complete text makes sense. What does it mean to move to signal? An academic paper also affords multiple opportunities for signaling. That is, for using the signal delivery mechanism to create the anticipation in the reader's mind as what is to come. The title, the very first paragraphs, the subheads, the roadmap, the main claim, all should trigger this kind of anticipation. Even individual words can do it. The signals that structure a paper are consciously deployed by the author. The author must craft them carefully. If they are too subtle, the reader might miss the point. If they're too heavy-handed, the reader might be annoyed. In the process of writing, the usual procedure is to start with clear, overly simplistic signals. They draw attention to themselves. They're heavy-handed. But as the paper goes through revisions, they become less and less obvious. Good writing has clear signals. Better writing, or excellent writing, exercises judgment in the amount of intellectual work that it asks the reader to do in jumping from promise to delivery. In effect, the author's revisions renaturalize the signals, so they flow with the narrative. The aim of the final revision is to make the signals transparent enough to give the reader a pleasure in discovery, but clear enough so that he or she doesn't get lost. The difference between sign and signal may be succinctly stated. A sign points to something. A signal promises something. I hope you're still with me. Let's ask ourselves, can a sign be good or bad? Can signifiers point to signifies correctly or incorrectly? I don't think so, but I leave that to those who are more expert in semiotic analysis than I. But certainly, signals may promise badly or well, incorrectly or correctly, because they are mechanisms, signal delivery, promise delivery. They can suffer breakdowns. And here are four ways in which signals can break down. A signal can promise something that never gets delivered. A signal can, or something can be delivered that wasn't properly signaled in advance. Something may be signaled but improperly, using vague terminology, and it's unclear. A signal might be misplaced, perhaps following rather than preceding what is to be delivered. Now, in the title of my paper, which I repeat, is From Sign to Signal, Lessons from Two Texts on Liberal Education in Poland and Russia, there are several promises. Sign indicates the semiotic analysis, but not very clearly. But in a semiotics conference, I think we get it. The move from sign to signal is meant to be a little bit of a provocation. What does this mean? Liberal education is a substantive term that indicates the topic, and presumably will be developed in the narrative. So if it isn't, it's a bad signal. Poland and Russia locate the discussion geographically, and I want to... contrast that to the two, the Poland and the Russia articles. The Poland article, place of liberal education, post-Soviet higher education. You wouldn't know that this is, focused on. That this really has a focus. The topic is too broad. And now I want to take a close look at number six and number the two articles, Poland, the one on Poland and on Russia, and look at the terms in them and ask which title tells the reader more, which one has the better signals. The Poland article, I think, is misleading on several points. Post-Soviet Poland would have been better. The wages of not being able to read your own typing. I guess I object to the term post-Soviet in regard to higher education in reference to Poland. Even in the 90s, this was not a post-Soviet country. Certainly now, it's a misunderstanding. The term, the place, is what I would call a thesis statement. I mean, this article will tell you about the place of this and that, the role for this. But it doesn't say what the role would be. It doesn't give you any kind of encouragement or doesn't draw your interest. The Russia article has much crisper, I think, signals. The reader is not only informed about what will come, but is enticed to be curious about it. The geography and history are clear in post-Soviet Russia. Against the tide and foothold are much more informative than the other title's place. The reader knows that liberal arts, whatever that might mean, is waging a heroic, if uneven struggle. The Russia title states what I think is a pretty strong claim. This will argue, will show, will lay out how against all odds, the liberal arts have managed to establish themselves in today's Russia, even if precariously. There's one more signal that's I think a very And that's the introductory section. So it's extremely important to have one. The Poland article doesn't. The two articles have basically the same strategy in laying out what they have to say. They examine the existing institutional landscape of education in Poland and in Russia, and then they go on to look at specific instances of liberal education. And the Poland article simply plunges right into the institutional landscape, so that the reader is really wondering, why am I reading this? The Russia article is much better organized because it I doubt that you'll be able to read much of this while I'm speaking, but it's it gets down to brass facts in the very first sentence, delivering on the promise contained in Against the Tide. It talks about liberal arts education as being relatively minor, but potentially playing a larger role. It also defines liberal arts education, and it concludes with a roadmap. In this article, I'm going to do this, and then that, and then that, and then that. All of which is are very helpful in orienting the reader. Okay, so much for the sort of the way that the articles are set up. What are they talking about? We need to decode certain terms to establish the context in which they move. Let's start with anomalies. Troublesome terms that translate poorly or that are rejected by the receiving culture. One of these is the very the example of a valuable liberal arts initiative in Russia is the article talks about Smolny College. It's Smolny College in English. In Russian, it's translated as Smolny Institute. Why? Well, obviously, there are historical reasons for this initiative appears in St. Petersburg at St. Petersburg State University, so there are historical reasons to talk about Smolny, which was an academy established by Catherine II for education of noble young women in an array of subjects. But the choice of college versus institutes reveals a conflict in codes. For Americans, the tradition that is worth continuing is the broad liberality of the education provided to Russian young women. For Americans, the word college marries two traditions, one from Russian history and one from the American experience of liberal arts colleges. For Russians, the word college sounds somehow wrong, so why not stick with institute? What about the term college at the University of Warsaw? We have handled the term gently here, let me say, so as we not to offend our American colleagues, but really kept it at an arm's length because it's really not part of the Polish tradition. The term liberal education is another anomaly. The Russian article mentions its untranslatability or awkward translatability. The editor of the volume admits that very few people in the world outside of the United States understand the term. And that includes people who are who sympathetic to the ideals that are included in it. Let me just remind you, it's an important reminder, that liberal education refers to more to form than to content. Liberal means student autonomy and possibility of a student choosing his or her own courses, rather than burdening students with requirements that lock him into a department. Why is it so misunderstood? Well, the editor says, perhaps because in transitional countries, economic development, social development, political development is much more important than education, so it's just something we can't... But that begs the question. We want to ask, why educators and the educated elites in Poland and Russia, why are they uncomfortable with the term? The authors of the book talk about the legacy of the Soviet period. That's the reason. It's the heavy burden of regimentation. I don't think that's it. I think there's a longer history that's involved. The editor of the book provides a short sort of history, global history, of liberal education. She begins with the classical Greeks and Romans through the medieval universities to Britain and then to America. The idea was exported from Britain to America. So that trajectory is very instructive, I think, because of what it leaves out. It leaves out what was happening in Europe at the time when this exportation to America took place. The Russian article, Russia article, devotes exactly one sentence to the history of liberal arts prior to the Soviet period. It says, "Russian educational structures of the late 19th and early 20th centuries in schools and universities demonstrated a spirit of academic exploration, particularly in the humanities, including Smolny Institute, after which our college is named." So this article says that there were institutions that had similar ideas to liberal education before the Soviet period. If so, what happened to them? To make a long story short, I think what happened to them is that they were displaced by as a category by the research university on the Humboldtian model, a model that spread across to Europe in the 19th century. The rigid and therefore illiberal curricula in Polish and Russian universities that are bemoaned in this book in the 1990s are not so much a legacy of the Soviet period, because they existed before the Soviet period. They're more a legacy of the model of the research university. Well, if that's what happened to liberal education in Poland and Russia, what happened to it in the United States? Why did it grow and develop? I think the answer is also the Humboldtian University. Not its presence, but its absence. Its late arrival on American shores was a minimum condition for the continued existence of the colleges of the colonial period and their development into the enduring, into enduring and iconic institutions of American social life. So, in America, the model of small, elite colleges dedicated to holistic training of society's leaders was cut off from its European roots when it arrived on American soil. It benefited from this separation in much the same way that democracy in America benefited from its separation from Europe, the famous thesis of Alexis de Tocqueville. The paradoxical result was that the same liberal arts education that in Europe wilted and sort of grew weak in the shadow of the research university was able to develop and grow strong in the United States. The model of liberal education, therefore, in the United States grew as a patois phenomenon. The American college preserved, in some respects, what it inherited from the old world, but in other important ways transformed itself to adapt to the rapid pace of the new world's social, political, and economic development. By the 20th century, it looked completely different than it did at its start in the early 1700s. And you have to picture the beginning of American colleges. Yale College was founded by a small cabal of dour Protestant elders who escaped the Massachusetts colony because those Puritans were having too much fun. They wanted to train elites in a very strict form of Protestantism. Those people could not have imagined what the American college looks like today. So I think it's the point of this little story is that it's a quirk of history that the patois phenomenon that liberal education was, being cut off from its sources in Europe, is now returning from its exile in America and trying to make inroads in Europe, and is being greeted with less than full enthusiasm. The book and these articles are talking about the undergraduate curriculum. They are trying to determine what we should teach undergraduates. Who are they talking about, undergraduates? How do we translate this term into Polish or Russian? Let me give you a picture of the American undergraduate. It's a young person who may or may not possess basic skills in writing or communication and techniques of study needed for college work. It's a person who would benefit from systematically presented foundations in human, social, and natural sciences. It's a person who very often is leaving home for the first time and looks forward to 4 years of a very favorable relation of freedom to responsibility. This time will be spent by most undergraduates in exploration. Parents and college officials hope there will be a favorable relation of intellectual to social exploration. Finally, although most undergraduates do not much listen to or credit exhortations and welcome speeches, they must listen to when they arrive in college, both they and their instructors appreciate the value of intellectual curiosity, participation in extracurricular activities, and commitment to social action outside its walls. Compare that to the Polish university student. How many of these notes apply? The point is that there are two separate codes operating in the discussion. When we say we want to discuss what we should be teaching undergraduates, we have to have a picture of who the undergraduates are, and the pictures are very, very different. All right, with all of that, the pictures of the differences, the pictures of the need to decode terms and practices, let me say I just sort of skipped over or skipped through several pictures. Much more needs to be done. Let's try to give some feedback. What can the experiences in Poland and Russia contribute to the global discussion on liberal education? And I say global intentionally because there is now a plague of joint ventures, of attempts to establish international structures by American universities and colleges, especially in Middle Eastern and Asian countries. It seems to me that the Polish and Russian experiences might have something specific to say about that. How am I doing on time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. So the first contribution, it should be evident from the argument in this paper, is that context matters. Participants to an international discussion must not only pay attention to the accuracy of translation of key terms, they must also be alert to ways in which historical and cultural context determine the codes in which discussion takes place. The fact that Smolny College appears in Russian as Smolny Institute is already a warning sign. It may in the end be the right translation. It may be in the end the right strategy. It may not be a problem. But we should really ask, why can't we use college in both languages? Or why not use Smolny Institute in both languages? Secondly, there must be a conscious effort to determine the context by decoding terms and practices in each academic culture. Imagine a Venn diagram. Venn diagrams. Each code is represented by a circle. Are the circles congruent? Do they cover each other? Become one code? Are they separate? How much overlap is there? It's possible that the Polish and Russian and American circles overlap, but not really likely. Not true now, and may not be in the foreseeable future. So words like university, words like graduate, undergraduate student, words like college, what are the different meanings? Thirdly, the definition of liberal education operative in any discussion needs to be specified. There are many ways to understand the term, but unless we specify something, what we're talking about, we have no chance in getting the circles to find points of intersection. Fourthly, and I recommend these chapters to you, their second sections are more interesting than the first, the description of the landscape of higher education, like perhaps the higher education itself, is tedious. But these two chapters discuss two models in particular, one in Russia and one in Poland, that they think are worth looking at because of what they teach us, what they tell us about the effort to establish liberal education. The first model in Russia is the Smolny College Institute. It's a partnership between St. Petersburg University and Bard College. It's an example of a college established within a large research university. There are many like this in the United States. Large research universities, University of Michigan, University of California, University of California, Berkeley, Los Angeles, etc., University of Chicago, within those structures, which have the full array of research, there are small places where undergraduates, these students coming for the first 4 years, have the experience of exploration of many different options, which they use as preparation for going on to graduate school. As the Russian article says, it documents that the effort to establish this Smolny College was fraught with misunderstandings and the need to navigate bureaucratic mazes. But both sides, and I think I've observed this, both sides actually brought a good bit of goodwill to the project, and they're making an attempt to bring these two circles together. And it's a very worthwhile model to look at when you see such enterprises as Yale University in Singapore, which is exportation of a model, implantation in a different context. Why they're doing it, it's hard to tell. The second model at the University of Warsaw is the sequence of institutional arrangements that have been created by Professor Oxer and his colleagues, beginning in the hurly-burly years of the 1990s. MISC, AAL, Collegium Artes Liberales. At the beginning, in the 90s, the old institutional order of People's Poland, including higher education, was falling apart. New authorities had not yet taken their place, So it was a good time for innovation. Interestingly, and I think the participants would agree with this, they did not at first realize they were speaking the prose of liberal education in forming MISC. There was a problem, and a problem needed to be solved, and MISC was an answer for it. They didn't do it because they had an idea of establishing a college or liberal education. What would the Venn diagram look like in another possibility? And I can't draw, but let me try to draw a gear. And this is probably what's happening today in the case of Poland and Russia. Well, you get the point. There are two gears with missing teeth. At certain points, they come together, but at certain points, they're completely talking in separate universes.
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, very good. This is maybe the most... the fifth and final point of suggestion as to what the experiences in Poland and Russia might, specifically in Poland, I guess, might contribute to a world discussion on liberal education, is that they can lead to a rethinking of the relationship of what Americans would call teaching, graduate training, and research. At what point in the career of a student earning a doctorate is liberal education most appropriate, most helpful? The title of the book talks about the liberal arts curriculum, the undergraduate liberal arts curriculum. So the title of the book and the book's editor assumes that liberal education is for undergraduates, for students. Let me give... that's the assumption that I want to examine here. Now let me give two quick sketches of the student experience on the way to the doctorate. The first one is from American culture, which I experienced. There are three stages: undergraduate, college, graduate school, 2 or 3 years, and then research and writing of the PhD. Every student who gets a doctorate passes through these stages. The first college stage, is a time of gathering general information, often very broadly, from humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, for gaining the basic skills in oral communication and written expression needed for academic life, for maturing in the values of academic honesty and respect for thinking of others, and for weighing the choice of a particular discipline or research topic to pursue. For those who wish to go on to the PhD, the next stage, after the BA or BS, going to graduate school, consists of 3 years of coursework and comprehensive examinations in a disciplinary department to master the literature in that discipline, its approaches to various subject matters, and its research methodologies, so that the information, disciplinary knowledge, really comes in graduate school, after student experience. The final stage is a year or two of research in archives or in the field, writing a dissertation. This admittedly cramped précis of the American doctorate shows what we might think of as a funnel-shaped process. So it starts broadly, a capacious opening that's designed to allow the greatest possible inflow of ideas, topics, and interests, and then progressively narrows to a strong, focused stream that can be directed by the individual, by the student, on the subject of the doctorate. The American system has its flaws, but it works. It produces PhDs. It's in fact highly valued. Students the world over vote with their feet to invest in getting an American doctorate. Now I want to give a picture of the career of a Polish student on the way to a doctorate. I'm nervous in this audience trying to do that, but here goes. The first stage is really at the secondary level, at which pupils are drilled in basic information in the humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. So students arriving at the university know a lot more than American students do when they arrive at college, even than they perhaps when they leave college. The basic information in the disciplines doesn't really begin intensively and in a systematic way until graduate school. So back to Poland. The next step is not 4 years of liberal maturing, but consisting of enrolling in research university departments, in which one will get a degree. The functions of an American graduate school are performed at the Polish undergraduate level. So the disciplinary training happens at university, not afterwards. Students get rigorous instruction in the literature, training methods, and socialization into the discipline. By the end of 5 years, as a student, undergraduate, the student is presumed to be ready to write a doctorate, to write up a dissertation prospectus, and to be accepted into a doctoral program. Is this a funnel system? No. How to describe it? I think it's more like an internal combustion system. Subject matter, facts and methods are compressed progressively in the stages. In the student as cylinder. Pressure mounts until there comes a moment, maybe with an external spark or maybe spontaneously, boom, an explosion occurs and a dissertation appears. The Polish system works. It produces dissertations. But let's ask, ideally, is it the funnel or the compression cylinder that is likely to produce dissertations that are innovative, willing to take intellectual risks, to follow inspiration, to pursue anomalies in the research, to deviate from the disciplinary canon? I'll leave that as a rhetorical question. I do not want to answer it, but I just want to... and I note that the Polish PhD is changing, so it's the point of the comparison is not to judge which is better, but to show how utterly different the two academic cultures are. The word undergraduate cannot be used, or doctorate even, cannot be used without decoding it. So in the Polish context, the question is, at what point in this trajectory should we apply liberal education? Insofar as I have an answer, I would say certainly liberal education is useful at the student level. But it's liberal education not in the sense of general education. Polish university students do not need more facts, more information about... they have those facts. Question is, do they have the skills to do something with them? And that's where liberal education can be valuable. And I think that's what the courses at the Collegium Artes Liberales, let me immodestly mention the ones that I did at the beginning, the Academic Writing in English and the Stryka Pracy Naukowej, try to do that. In other words, try to take individuals who have an enormous foundation, funds of knowledge, and help them be able to express it orally or in a written way. I think the liberal arts approach might also be useful in shaping the new doctoral studies in Poland. I worry about doctorates, about doctoral students who have had this high-pressure education, you know, since secondary school, and how they are able to to be creative after that that kind of training. There's a they must have imbibed a very positivistic mentality toward toward their education, toward the research that they're doing. Positivistic in the sense of we accumulate knowledge, and my place is to add another brick to that knowledge. And positivistic in the sense that facts, the world is all that is the case. Facts count. Facts are either true or false. If it's not a fact, it doesn't really fit. It's a very useful term that I heard Polish students use about liberal arts. What are they? They're odhamiacze. And I think if we see education as a cylinder, we need maybe not an odhamiacz, but we need a relief valve. And that's liberal education can serve. And it would be useful to talk about that, not just in Poland, but in other places as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dziękuję bardzo. Proszę nie opuszczać miejsca, bo będziemy, na pewno pojawią się jakieś pytania. Proszę panią profesor o zajęcie miejsca również przy stole. Proszę państwa, będziemy... Tutaj bardzo proszę do mikrofonu. Bardzo proszę o zadawanie pytań, formułowanie uwag, co Państwo życzycie sobie powiedzieć na temat dwóch referatów tej sesji. Bardzo proszę.
Presentation, and I really would love to take part in your courses in academic English and scientific writing. I'm sure my readers and students will be very grateful for that. But I would like to ask you two questions. First, I'm not sure if I grasped correctly the division between signs and signals in your argument. Could you please elaborate on that? Because I always thought that signals are like cybernetic core that the signs could be made at, and that every sign is somehow a signal. And when I write an academic text, I use only signs that are like cultural form of signals, like the coding and decoding in cultural terms. And then we think of signs not only signals, but there are still signals, like they're can be affected by noise or breakdowns, as you mentioned. And my second question is really an exploitation of this, like Yale in Singapore or many like second-class American colleges that are coming to Poland now, is it really an exploitation of a model or an idea, or is it really an exploitation rather of a brand and a way of like colonial or post-colonial approach gain money using a particular brand rather than the fact that students are voting with their feet, choosing to get an education in American colleges? Isn't it rather a part of this system of very well-created economical machine? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for two really interesting papers. I've got a question for Professor Dymowski as well. And I find myself in a slightly strange position asking this question because I'm a great fan of the American system. And yet I find myself in disagreement with two of your sort of central theses. And the first one really is that about kind of what creates intellectual creativity. And this is completely anecdotal. If I compare the amount of kind of theoretical reflection I've had over the last 24 hours here with what I tend to hear at the large American and particularly British sort of subject association meetings, I've got to say I'm far more worried about how much creativity I'm witnessing on the other side of the British Channel and actually on the other side of the Atlantic than I am about the state of intellectual affairs here. But that's anecdotal and that's not particularly serious. I think more serious is what you said about academic writing in the first half of your paper. And again, I'm entirely with you. That's how I write and that's how I mark my students as having to write. But my question is really one about, I suppose, linguistic convention and stylistic particularities and how they map onto different nation states and their intellectual traditions. I think we need to be very aware of how differently structured arguments tend to be, not only in disciplinary terms, but actually in different language traditions. And I guess I'm a bit taken aback by the kind of universality of your demands. Again, this is how I write and that's how I judge good academic writing, but I know perfectly well that to many people writing in the French tradition and in the German tradition, those conventions don't apply, and I'm concerned about arguably the kind of, you know, sort of neocolonialism in that actually in terms of intellectual work. And actually sort of fitting this or articulating this slightly differently, whilst I'm with you on all those conventions, of course there's a big big problem in the Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American tradition of how we construct our arguments, which is that of circularity. You know, the more sort of explicit the signals you're calling for, quite often the less substantial the outline of the argument being developed. And that's a problem, I would argue, particularly in the humanities. I was going to say in the humanities and the social sciences, where there is no obvious method section, there is no obvious presentation of results section to then develop the argument. So how do you avoid circularity, and how do you avoid, you know, a kind of universal hegemony actually with the kinds of structural demands you seem to be dishing out universally? Thank you.
As for liberal education, I would like to share a very similar intuition to my colleagues, that I find positivism really seizing in the new Polish humanities, and that methodology and theory
really
seizing, stopping to be important.
Push the microphone.
That methodology and theory becomes gradually more and more important, and as we could witness here, and as we can read in the books that have been published by Polish academics in the last 10 years, for example. Miałem jeszcze pytanie do pierwszego referatu, o to wspomnieliśmy, to było sobie zadać się po polsku. Chciałem zapytać, gdzie według Pani można jeszcze szukać źródeł posthumanizmu jako metodologii, czy jako teorii, poza tymi dyskursami emancypacyjnymi, o których Pani mówiła, czyli poza feminizmem, poza postkolonializmem. I tak sobie myślę, jak słuchałem tego w tej wstępnej części Pani referatu o Arystotelesie, że ja nie jestem ekspertem od tego, ale miałem wrażenie, że trochę po macoszemu potraktowała Pani tradycję grecką, że w tradycji greckiej, w takim rozumieniu tego, że w greckiej filozofii, że każdy byt ma swój potencjał do wypełnienia, każdy byt ma jakieś swoje etyczne zobowiązanie wobec kosmosu, wobec wszechświata, człowiek również, a jako w jakimś sensie wyróżniony, bo formułujący to takie stanowisko, ale nie wyróżniony w żadnym innym sensie. I myślę sobie jeszcze o innej takiej charakterystycznej cesze tej kultury starożytnej Grecji, o takim postrzeganiu kosmosu czy wszechświata, który doskonale sobie poradziłby bez człowieka, który w ogóle sobie radzi bez człowieka, dla którego człowiek jest niekonieczny. I zastanawiam się, czy w tym Pani może poszukać sojuszników na przykład intelektualnych dla posthumanizmu, ale czy jeszcze gdzieś indziej w rozwoju myśli europejskiej widziała Pani jakieś takie jaskółki zapowiedzi tej metodologii posthumanistycznej?
Kto z Państwa jeszcze chciałby? Dziękuję.
Do pierwszego referatu, czyli pan profesor Grażyny Gajewski. To są raczej wątpliwości, ale nie do Pani wypowiedzi, tylko pytania dotyczące tego, co się dzieje w kulturze. Bo traktowana jako zbiór wartości pewnego typu tekstów jest czymś, co w zasadzie nieustannie przemieszcza się w obrębie mniej lub bardziej uporządkowanego systemu. I teraz mamy taki czas, że to pole się rozszerza. Ja bym tu do Pawła Dobrosielskiego zapytał, co jeszcze można by znaleźć, jakie jeszcze przyczyny można by znaleźć, które sprawiają, że my poszerzamy to pole. Z pewnego, znaczy ja akurat nie poszerzam, ale inne osoby poszerzają. Znaczy ja też poszerzam, bo ja się napisałem o Big Brotherze, to pytano mnie, czy ja jestem zdrowy na umyśle, czy się Mickiewicz, a nie Big Brotherze. I to jest, bo z mojej perspektywy to, co wchodzi w posthumanizm, jest czymś takim, jest w jakimś sensie związane w dużym stopniu właśnie z feminizmem. To trochę tak, jakby się ten feminizm wyczerpał, już nie mamy co z tym robić, szukamy nowych pól. Dlatego mówię o feminizmie, bo przecież na przykład językowe badania nad feminizmem wśród różnych badaczy, także dobory Tanem, związane były z tym, że one się zajmowały językami mniejszości. I kobiety tak, traktowane były jak mniejszość. Teraz w zasadzie mamy do czynienia z zainteresowaniem wykluczonymi, queer i inne rzeczy, albo z czymś, co było spychane na margines spychane na margines i uważane za nieistotny element kultury. Czy w związku z tym, takie jest tutaj moje pytanie, pani uważa, że to jest sprawa mody, konieczności poszerzenia zakresu, żeby coś, co, żeby humanista mógł się nazwać posthumanistą, w związku z tym był bardziej nowoczesny i odnajdywał jakieś nowe przestrzenie istotne badawczo? Czy też tu można by jeszcze coś innego znaleźć? No bo powtarzam tezę, jeszcze jutro ją powtórzę banalną, ale tutaj nie można uciec. Kultura jest zbiorem wartości. Wartościujemy dalej siebie inaczej niż zwierzęta. Wartościujemy inaczej kłamstwo innych niż kłamstwo własne. Zresztą mam w ogóle przekonanie, że my nie kłamiemy. Ogólnie rzecz biorąc, to Jolanta Atanas pokazała, że jest złudzeniem fikcyjnym, ale ten pewien typ relacji my, niekoniecznie inni ogólnie, ale my inne byty jest trwałym w języku. I to jako przyczynek, może to pani się też przyda, kiedy pani słuchała, przyszła mi do głowy formuła Wierzbickiej definiująca ludzi. I nie tak jak w dawnych słownikach, dwunożny, postawa wyprostowana, godzony homo sapiens. To jest taka formuła, która mnie bardzo urzekła. Ludzie to istoty takie jak my. W związku z tym, jeżeli kogoś nazywamy inaczej, to jakby odpisujemy go z tego gatunku, wartościując jako innego, gorszego. Co tyle. Natomiast do pana profesora Tymoskiego, ja mam takie pytanie, bo myśmy już wiele razy rozmawiali o tych klasach, innych uniwersytetach, wartościach, ale ja mam takie pytanie z, powiedziałbym, z semiotyki codzienności. Czy w świecie, który pan dobrze zna, edukacji w Stanach, istnieje jakby stały taki, może nie uniwersalny, ale w jakiejś części istotnej społeczeństwa zespół przekonań etykietalnych co do tego, że ten typ edukacji jest dobry, ten jest niedobry. Czy też zawsze on jest dobry dla kogoś, bo ja tu się odwołuję do doświadczeń polskich. Pamięta pan, jak z Jerzym Akselem, spółką się zastanawialiśmy nad początkami interdyscyplinarności jako sposobu uczenia ludzi. Ja kiedyś zobaczyłem w Warszawie autobus, gdzie było napisane szkoła wyższa Jana Kuniadego, zupełnie nieznanej postaci, jakaś nowo powstająca szkoła prywatna i tam było napisane jako slogan reklamowy, uczymy interdyscyplinarnie, to znaczy, że uczymy lepiej. Czy tego typu kwalifikacje istnieją w takiej potocznej świadomości tych, którzy się chcą uczyć w Stanach raczej, bo formują to. To ja tyle takich. Pan profesor gdzie?
To ja?
No nie, tak.
Przepraszam za spóźnienie, ale ja poszedłem tam do góry specjalnie na twój referat, a się okazało, że jest na dole. So should I speak English? It's better when I speak English, so everyone understands.
Because
he's bilingual, you know, he understands Polish very well.
As you are.
So I mean, my question is, I know it's very very simple and maybe stupid, but about relations between liberal education and liberalism, because when we talk about well, in Poland, you know, it's very often confused that when you say, you know, in Polish, because we don't have a very good equivalent, so our college here is called Collegium Artes Liberales, not Collegium Edukacji Liberalnej or of liberal education or liberal arts or whatever, because it's quite important, because many people think that you know, you have artes liberales, it's one thing, this medieval concept. You have liberal education, and you have liberalism, and like a few articles about relations between liberalism and liberal education, and liberal education, liberalism, and interdisciplinarity, because actually what we are trying to do here in this college is a kind of interdisciplinary education, and we've been discussing this for the last, you know, 5 years or 6 years with Andrzej, but liberal education and interdisciplinary education and liberalism. Your thoughts about relations between these three key issues, because liberal education, should it be interdisciplinary, and in what sense? And what's the relation between liberal education and liberalism in the Polish context, in your opinion? I know it's for another paper, but I'm sorry for that. But, you know, your thoughts.
Okay,
thank you.
Czy ktoś z Państwa jeszcze chciał? Bardzo proszę.
Bardzo dziękuję za te wspaniałe dwa referaty. Mam pytanie po polsku do profesora Tomowskiego. Właściwie taką, cieszę, to będzie już bardziej uwaga niż pytanie. Otóż jeżeli chodzi o te sposoby sygnalizowania, zapowiadania treści, chyba zapomnieliśmy o pewnej tradycji, która istniała pomiędzy XVI i końcem XVIII wieku, kiedy prace filozoficzne były obrazowane, czy myśli tej pracy zawarte były obrazowane ilustracją. Ilustracją przepełnioną różnymi symbolami, które w ten czy w inny sposób sygnalizowała jakby całość dzieła. Najbardziej znany oczywiście dla wszystkich to jest Hobbes z jego Lewiatanem. W pewnym momencie, właśnie kiedy tworzy się uniwersytet badawczy, spis treści zaczyna oddawać to, co kiedyś oddawały te ilustracje. I jakby cała uwaga skupiona jest na spisie treści i wstępie, odchodząc niejako od obrazowania, no w sensie dosłownym, tak, poprzez wycinek. I to jest o tyle dziwne, że obecnie po takiej inwazji kognitywistyki różne formy obrazowania myśli mogłyby na strony prac naukowych powrócić, dając niezwykle mocne narzędzia poruszania się czytelnika, dając w czasie mu pewną wolność, poruszania się po tekście. To jest jakby jedna rzecz. A druga rzecz, jeżeli chodzi o edukację w Polsce liberalną, to ja patrząc z perspektywy uniwersytetu o dużych tradycjach, ale najwyraźniej przypominającego obecnie taką sadzawkę w Afryce w czasie suszy, kiedy te krokodyle już tak nawzajem mają coraz mniej jedzenia, czyli nie mamy studentów, tak? Bo w Polsce problem jest głównie polega na tym, że pieniądze na uniwersytet idą za studentów. I w związku z tym one są dzielone bardzo wyraźnie pomiędzy poszczególne kierunki, ponieważ i student nie może być uczony gdzie indziej, ponieważ te pieniądze za nim nie pójdą, A więc problemy są często nie tyle w sensie braku pewnej teorii wychowania liberalnego, tak, czy edukacji liberalnej, co bardzo praktyczne. Bardzo praktyczne, to znaczy obecny system Ministerstwa Szkolnictwa Wyższego uniemożliwia na małych, profesjonalnych uniwersytetach stworzenie czegokolwiek, co by mogło przypominać
Dziękuję. Proszę Państwa,
mam nadzieję, że nie ma innych pytań, dlatego że już czas nam troszeczkę ucieka i w związku z czym poproszę Państwa referentów o ustosunkowanie się do wypowiedzi, może w takiej kolejności, w jakiej były wygłaszane wystąpienia. Bardzo proszę Panią Profesor.
Jak najbardziej.
O właśnie, proszę bardzo.
Jak najbardziej zgadzam się z tym, że tradycja antyczna jest o wiele szersza, różnorodniejsza i tak dalej. Dlatego ja na początku nie mówiłam, ja w ogóle nie używałam tutaj sformułowań typu tradycja antyczna, tylko konkretnie wskazywałam na tradycję arystotelesowską, tak? Czyli jakby ta linia jest tutaj przede wszystkim poddawana krytyce. Natomiast jakby argumenty w drugą stronę padają z tradycji antycznej również. Na przykład podaje się bardzo często filozofów, którzy byli wegetarianami, tak? Jakby podaje się jakby powody, dla których byli. To jest wizja świata, o której Pan mówił. Dlatego ja na początku, jak mówiłam, że wskazuję jakby pewne punkty, które są krytykowane przez humanizm. I to, że jeden z najczęstszych argumentów jest ta właśnie krytyka tej hierarchicznej struktury bytów u Arystotelesa, nie jest jednoznaczne z tym, że jest krytykowana cała tradycja. Wręcz przeciwnie, ona jest zbyt różnorodna i właściwie można znaleźć argumenty w jedną i w drugą stronę. Jeżeli chodzi o te źródła, także te źródła posthumanizmu, jeżeli się szuka takiej argumentacji filozoficznej czy antropologiczno-kulturowej, tam się też znajdzie. Znajduje się też je w kulturach pozaeuropejskich, takie, które mają inne nastawienie wobec przyrody. Tutaj najczęściej są to plemiona Indian z Ameryki Północnej. To jest jakby taki kontrapunkt dla postawy oświeceniowej w Europie, która była bardzo dążyła do poznania, skatalogowania, uporządkowania, a w konsekwencji także podporządkowania, czyli jak poznamy, jak działa przyroda, to będziemy mogli ją wykorzystać dla swoich potrzeb. I dlatego szuka się tutaj też takich źródeł poza Europą, zwłaszcza poza tą Europą okresu nowożytnego. Także tutaj się jak najbardziej zgadzam. I jedną z takich motywacji do zmian są na przykład wypowiedzi laureatów Nobla z zakresu fizyki, geologii, którzy wręcz nawet nie sugerują, jakby wprost mówią, że właściwie współczesna epoka geologiczna powinna być już zupełnie inaczej nazwana, powinna być nazwana od słowa antropos, ze względu na to, że człowiek tak dużej ingerencji dokonał, że właściwie w tej chwili my nie tylko jakby dezorganizujemy czy wpływamy na ten nasz lokalny system, ale na globalny, czyli na przykład wydobywania złóż węgla, ropy na masową skalę. To są zanieczyszczenia wielkich skupisk metropolii. To jest wycinka lasów na rzecz sadzenia zboża. Człowiek jakby wpływa tutaj w sposób znaczny na zmiany środowiska i stąd na przykład ci, którzy się zajmują geologią, wręcz jakby mówią, że współczesna epoka gdzieś tak od końca XIX wieku powinna mieć już wręcz geologicznie powinna w nazewnictwie mieć już słowo antropos ze względu na tak duże ingerencje. Nie mówiąc o ociepleniu klimatu, którym się nieustannie też dyskutuje. Także tych źródeł jest kilka i nie ma tutaj To nie jest jakby perspektywa liniowa, tak? Po prostu można, i jak najbardziej się zgadzam z tym, że tradycja antyczna jest jednym z takich obszarów, gdzie można znaleźć argumenty za. Także ja nie mówiłam w ogóle o tradycji antycznej, tylko jakby zdecydowanie o tym jednym aspekcie, który jest najczęściej krytykowany, gdzie się rodzi wyraźna ta perspektywa jakby hierarchiczna. Jeśli chodzi tutaj o pytania pana profesora o poszerzenie pola i czy to jest moda. Ja myślę, że swego czasu takie pytania stawiano na przykład postmodernizmowi. Czy zajmujemy się, bo to jest modne, czy dlatego, że ma to sens. I wszyscy wiemy dobrze o tym, że zdania były podzielone, bo ludzie też się z różnej perspektywy zajmowali. Niektórzy dlatego, że to jest modne, inni dlatego, że znaleźli w tym interesujący sposób na przewartościowanie pewnego sposobu myślenia w sztuce, w humanistyce, w organizacji społecznej i tak dalej. Myślę, że tak samo jest tutaj, że dla wielu ludzi słowa takie jak posthumanizm, posthumanistyka, transhumanizm i tak dalej są takimi słowami wytrychami na zasadzie właśnie nowości, mody, ale są też ludzie, którzy zajmują się tym na poważnie właśnie ze względu na to, że widzą jakby perspektywę, pewne wyzwania związane z innym, nowym postrzeganiem jakby świata i siebie usytuowania w tym świecie. Bo posthumanistyka ma to do siebie, że jakby zmusza do rewizji też własnych postaw wobec innych bytów. Jeżeli mówimy tutaj o tym pytaniu wyczerpania feminizmu, to tak. Odpowiedź jest twierdząca. Feminizm w tej chwili jest w takim momencie pewnego przeformułowania i pewnego kryzysu. O tym też piszą nawet polskie tutaj badaczki, jak Inga Iwasiów, często to podkreśla, Ewa Kraskowska. Jakby jest, szuka się jakby nowych przestrzeni. Tak? Jakby na przykład Donna Haraway wyraźnie postuluje przymierze kobiet z maszynami. To jest ten cyberfeminizm, który na Zachodzie jest bardzo, był w latach 90. bardzo rozwinięty. W Polsce on się nigdy nie pojawił, ze względu na to, że to nie był jeszcze ten czas, żeby można było się takimi rzeczami. Natomiast ekofeministki są zdecydowanie bliżej postaw posthumanistycznych. Czyli można tutaj mówić jakby o pewnych poszerzaniu pola ze względu na światopogląd. Jeżeli nie ma czegoś takiego jak feminizm, są tylko feminizmy i na przykład skrajnymi przykładami są właśnie ekofeministki i cyberfeministki, dlatego cyberfeministki widzą bardziej przymierze kobiet z maszynami, a ekofeministki właśnie zwierzęta i tak dalej, jakby zupełnie inny typ refleksji rozbudowują. Ale zgadzam się, że jest to związane jakby z... To jest po prostu zakończenie pewnego etapu działań feminizmu i szukanie kolejnego pola. I to jest konsekwencja właśnie to, o czym pan profesor mówił też tutaj, jeśli chodzi o zbiór wartości. To jest poszukiwanie jakby nowych sposobów emancypacji kolejnych grup, tak jak były to kiedyś kobiety, ludzie czarnoskórzy i tak dalej. To jest kolejna forma jakby emancypacji. Zresztą ona biegnie takimi, jak się przyjrzymy, schematowi, w jaki to przebiega, to on jest dokładnie taki sam. Czyli najpierw się mówi, że jesteśmy, pierwsza faza to jest taka, że mówi się, że jesteśmy tacy sami. Tak samo było w feminizmie, gdzie podkreślało, my kobiety jesteśmy takie same jak mężczyźni. Druga faza jest już inna, kiedy się mówi, nie jesteśmy takie same, jesteśmy inne, ale szanujmy te różnice. I tak samo jest tutaj. Najpierw była w tej refleksji posthumanistycznej. Pierwszy etap był taki, my jesteśmy zwierzętami, tak? Taki jest nasz rodowód. Druga faza była taka, że mówi się, jesteśmy zwierzętami, ale ludzkimi. W związku z czym inaczej funkcjonujemy, ale to też skłania do tego, by myśleć o zwierzętach nie z pozycji antropocentrycznej, tylko to są inni nasi krewni, mają inne, w inny sposób wyposażyła ich natura i tak dalej. To przebiega tymi dokładnie samymi ścieżkami, tak samo jak było z ruchem socjalistycznym, jak było z postkolonialnym. Są pewne schematy. Można się z tym zgadzać lub nie, to znaczy postfumaniści uważają, że najtrudniejsze jest przełamanie postawy antropocentrycznej, to co o czym Pan, systemu wartości. Jeżeli dla humanisty zajmującego się zwłaszcza zawodowo, jakby zanurzonego w filozofii, tradycji tutaj zachodnioeuropejskiej, jakby wyjście poza kategorie humanistyczne jest olbrzymie, jest bardzo trudne. Jakby to jest chyba jedno z największych takich wyzwań i najtrudniejsze. I ja nie mam zamiaru tutaj przekonywać do tego, że to jest słuszne lub niesłuszne, tylko wskazuję, że, z czego wynikają jakby argumenty posthumanizmu, w jakim kierunku oni się poruszają. Dla mnie jest to jedna z ciekawszych perspektyw, ale na przykład są też inne, na przykład transhumanizm, który na przykład całkowicie odrzuca tę kwestię ekologiczną, ale postuluje silne przymierze z maszynami, łącznie z projektami przyznania praw maszynom. Na takiej samej zasadzie, jak się mówi w tej chwili o prawach zwierząt, na przykład transhumaniści mówią o prawach maszyn. No jest jeszcze ten trzeci nurt, który się nazywa antropologią rzeczy, która wskazuje na sprawczość rzeczy, nie tylko sprawczość ludzi, ale także sprawczość rzeczy. To są takie nowe trendy, do których możemy podejść albo bardziej otwarty, albo w bardziej pesymistyczny sposób. Natomiast one są według mnie intelektualnie ciekawym wyzwaniem i to jakby w tym sensie uważam je za bardzo interesujące.
Dobrze, dziękuję. Thanks for all the comments. I'm glad to get the pushback. You are right when you say that the guidelines for writing are apodictic and stiff, that the pictures I drew were caricatures, but I just, you know, did the best I could with the limited amount of time. Let me try to answer the specific questions. Sign and signal. I confess I'm doing code switching here between in trying to use sign and the theoretical apparatus that goes with it, along with signal, which I took out of writing guidelines, and tried to use that in as a way of explicating these texts. In other words, trying to understand what this book is telling us, whether it's significant, and using those two traditions, those two kinds of apparatus, to go beyond the text to try to discover the context, and to break down the text into its parts. As I said, the most succinct way to put the difference is that a sign points to something, and a signal, the way I'm using it, the word, promises something. And okay, we can talk about that more if you'd like. The models of the sort of gush of global interest in international campuses of American colleges and universities. It is an export of brands. I mean, I think most of those enterprises are Singapore wants to get the name of Yale University, and Yale University wants to get the money. I've asked professors at Yale, why are you doing this? I mean, what's the... And they say, well, you know, we can experiment, we can do things, we can set up curricula that we... And that's why I think Smolny is worth looking at, because those people are doing it not because they want to make money, but because they have this idea that a liberalizing the education or presenting students in Russia with a liberal education, that's an opportunity that's worth pursuing. It's an exchange program, which I didn't mention, which also is sort of very interesting. They get a joint degree. They've made great progress. I mean, there's still problems when you look at it up close, but they're doing it from an idealistic point of view. Creativity in American dissertations or not. These were ideal descriptions and caricatures. Surely there's, for one thing, it's right to say, as you pointed out, that education in Poland is not as bad as maybe I presented it. And certainly the people that I met at this conference and the people that are take my classes, I mean, if that's what, the present and future of Polish education is, you are really way ahead. But I'm not sure that that's how widespread this experience is, one, and two, the conception of how doctorates are produced. There are two different conceptions, and one is the funnel, and the other is the pressure chamber. And if we change this, maybe it. Anyway, it's worth discussing the differences. And one thing that the book points out, which is telling, I think, is that the curriculum is a constant subject of discussion in the United States at all levels, mostly at the undergraduate level, but at the other levels as well. Whereas here, it's set. There's only Collegium Artes Liberales, which has a discussion, and I think pan ma zupełną rację, że pieniądze idą na edukację za studentem. So that the i to było wskazane w tej książce, w tych artykułach o Polsce i Rosji, że system instytucjonalny jest w ogóle nie pozwala na jakieś eksperymenty, utrudnia i tak dalej, i tak dalej. Ale tym niemniej w Ameryce jest ochota, żeby pomyśleć o czymś innym, a tutaj jest nawet, nie wiem, mniejsza ochota, powiedzmy, do eksperymentów. Przy czym system się, znaczy wyższego wykształcenia się ogromnie zmienił w Polsce. Zmienia się w tempie nieprawdopodobnym. Więc to też trzeba uznać. The stylistic differences, the fact that I was so apodictic in brief presentation, trying to make a point. There are stylistic cultural differences. A Chinese colleague once put it to me this way. The English sentence is like a train. You have the subject as the locomotive, the verb sort of pulled along a track. A Chinese sentence is like a fan. You have an idea that emanates in various. Well, if that's your image of what a sentence is and how you communicate, structuring an argument is going to look completely differently. Germans, I studied German philosophy for many years, and one of my first professors warned me that be careful, because as you start to understand German philosophy, people will stop understanding you. there are different styles. I think it's worth talking about academic communication, especially in an international context. Students, doctoral, going to an international conference, how should they prepare their text? It's better to start with something that's clear and not circular, but maybe well sort of signaled in advance, simplistic in that sense, but clear, so that you could tell what the argument is, than to be creative and aesthetically pleasing and poetic, but, you know. The point is to go beyond the simple instructions. Czy jeden system jest lepszy od drugiego?
Jest takie społeczne wartościowanie trwałości.
trwałe. To znaczy, społeczne wartościowanie jest, że college się liczy. Kiedyś było tak, że high school, znaczy to jest wykształcenie, ale teraz praktycznie każdy musi mieć jakieś po high school. Teraz liberal arts colleges w Stanach teraz uporają się z kryzysem, bo studenci nie chcą się zapisywać. Jeżeli się zapisują, chcą biznes, a nie jakieś tam historie, czy języki, coś takiego niepotrzebne. Więc znaczy to dowartościowanie jest w college, ale jakie wartości, czy co jest warte studiowania, się zmienia i jest bardzo płynne. Liberalism, liberal education, a liberal arts college. Freedom is the common concept, but it shows how little liberal education is understood in the continent which gave it birth, that you have that kind of problem. I could just add to that that there's a concept called liberal studies in the United States. You know, in trying to see what it might mean to have a PhD in liberal arts, you find liberal studies. Those are MA programs. They're for working adults. So they're for people who are out. You know, so there really is no conception of liberality in the United States past the college level. When you get to graduate school, when you start your PhD, you're not doing liberal studies anymore. You are being trained in a discipline.
Liberal studies for free citizens, but like...
Well, for free for working adults. In other words, they're so studia podyplomowe dla tych, którzy się, and they're excellent. They're great. I mean, there is a exhilarating freedom when you meet to discuss because you want to meet to discuss, and not because you know you have to get a grade, and you know this is going to make a difference in your career in some specific way. But okay.